Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 46, and today I'm joined by Corey Wong, who is a graduate student in the Department of Philosophy here at Penn State, and she's working on effective embodiment and oppression, and specifically the role of that philosophy might play in addressing these issues of embodiment and oppression. And I invited her to the Digital Dialogue today because she's been involved in a very interesting initiative designed to cultivate the public practice of philosophy. This endeavor centers around the Public Philosophy Network website, which I'll put a link to on the website. And that site is designed to cultivate, sustain, and develop the practice of public philosophy. So, Corey Wong, welcome to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you very much, Chris.
So maybe we should start by talking a little bit about the Public Philosophy Network and then talk a little bit about sort of what got you onto the Digital Dialogue, which was your asking me some questions about the Digital Dialogue and whether it could be a model for other kinds of engagement. So let's talk a little bit about what this network is.
Well, the Public Philosophy Network is designed to provide virtual spaces that will help create and foster collaboration and productive spaces for people to work together, to exchange ideas, and also to facilitate real collaboration and spaces for people to engage in public work with philosophy. So the public is vaguely defined. It can be people who work in public policy, people who are outside of the academy. And the other element of the network is to try to get conversations going about mentorship, too, facilitate relationships, not only as collaborative research projects, but also to help guide those up-and-coming junior scholars or graduate students who might be interested in doing public work and how to do their work in ways that are successful and effective based on the leadership and guidance from people who have already been successful in their own endeavors.
Right. So part of the idea of the network is to extend philosophy out beyond the sort of sometimes insulated academic world.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is including academics, right?
Yeah. That's part of the point. Of course. Part of the point is to get collaborative projects in academic philosophy, too, so that you can see that you're not alone if you're interested in doing publicly engaged philosophy, but that there might be other people at other institutions, other universities who are doing similar work, and it's just really a means by which you can connect and network with people who are doing that kind of work, too. Right. So to really get a community of people who are involved so it doesn't feel like you're up against the whole world and on your own.
Right. And so and this came out of the a committee of the American Philosophical Association, or where is that where it came from?
Right. There's the subcommittee that was in the APA, and then there was a conference about a year ago in San Francisco getting the initial conversations going about what sort of things might be needed to help facilitate actual public practice in philosophy. And this website came out of those conversations at the conference in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. So is there a specific kind of conception of public that is meant by in this endeavor, or is it a very broad sort of understanding what public means?
It's very broad, but it's intentionally vague and ambiguous. So part of the network has forums for discussion, and there's a discussion on theoretical conversations about public philosophy and the nature of it. Mm-hmm. So trying to understand what sort of public it is that we're talking about is much a part of the question that we leave open in terms of who's doing public work, what counts as public work, and what publics are you engaging in.
Right. So just to give people a sense of the site itself, I mean, there's a little bit of a Facebook-like feel to it. Mm-hmm. You can create a profile, right? You can you get mail through it, because that's how we started talking. Other than our face-to-face conversations, we started talking. It's one of the interesting things about this was that we're on the same campus and we see each other every so often, but then we started communicating through the Public Philosophy Network, and after I posted the Digital Dialogue as one of these affinity groups. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what an affinity group is.
Right. Well, so in addition to the forums where there could be continuous conversations and discussions going on about various topics, there's other features that the Public Philosophy Network offers, including resources that we're compiling additional resources for things that might be helpful, like groups and organizations, institutes like the Rock Ethics Institute or other public policy institutes through other universities, and especially affinity groups. And the affinity groups are basically small subgroups that are sort of created based on interests of whoever wants to make an affinity group.
So anybody who's a
member can start an affinity group. Okay. So we have someone like pedagogy in the classroom or gender and love and queer politics. And then members join those affinity groups, and that's a quick and easy way to see who else is interested in the work that you're interested in. But then hopefully the ideas of the affinity groups are to help create that collaboration. Nice. You can have discussions internally to the affinity groups themselves, or even start like actually raising questions and having really substantial conversations that could turn out into more research-based.
And are there specific? I know we're just starting with this endeavor, but are there specific initiatives or intentional ways of bringing non-academics into this? Because I could see those of us who are in the academic world, you know, flocking to something like this because, you know, we'll see our friend, our colleagues doing it and see the power of it. But how are we going to get, you know, people who are not experts and not professionals?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's sort of something we've been addressing right now because part of the problem. It's also bizarre that just this past week, as I was kind of looking at the Public Philosophy Network and trying to figure out ways that we can streamline it and make things a little bit more intuitive for the members, I got an email from someone who's not a member, and they're not affiliated with a university, but they found some of the stuff that I have been posting and responded to my questions about how do you go public, what does it mean to do philosophy publicly, and they were very supportive, gave me basically their name, and then just said, like, hopefully your generation can do these things, and these are the sort of challenges that you're up against. And so it's hard to get members to be active because right now one of the things we're addressing is there are people we're calling like the lurkers who just are visiting the site and seeing what's going on but maybe not being fully involved as members. But there, I mean, the idea of the Public Philosophy Network is to be just as accessible and welcoming to non-academic professional philosophers but also public practitioners.
Right,
so people who are directly engaged in public policy because that is one of the areas of the public that we're hoping to address.
So before we talk a little bit about how, you know, my project of the Digital Dialogue relates to this, because I think there's all kinds of exciting ways that it does, I wanted to ask you about how your own work is related to these issues of publicness. And, and I mean, I just briefly mentioned the notion of affective embodiment and oppression. And I recognize, too, that you're in the stage of your graduate career where you're beginning to formulate sort of a direction of it. So I don't mean to sort of have you give me a full-fledged sort of account. But how is this this endeavor, at least with the Public Philosophy Network, fitting in with your own philosophical interests?
Philosophically, I approach philosophy as a practice that is intended to directly affect our real lives of everyday character. And so far as I've been teaching my classes, I try to relate to my students in ways that are very meaningful to them. Like, it doesn't have to be strictly, I don't know, academic-based philosophy where we're just going to hash out the arguments in a text. But I've had more success in my introductory classes with non-major students to have them see the ways that philosophically thinking, writing and speaking and reading too, how that can actually affect them on issues of like how they relate to their boyfriends or girlfriends or how they associate in their communities and stuff. And so the public element of my own work is deeply embedded in the research that I do, especially addressing issues of like homophobia, transphobia, racism, sexism, that kind of stuff. And one of my goals is to try to see how, in one of the most like easy, superficial understandings of public philosophy, how to get philosophy to be more public outside of the academy. So I've done other things too. I've kind of toyed around with ideas about blogs and posting videos on YouTube and seeing what other means through which you can engage people in philosophical thinking outside of just a university classroom.
Right. Well, that's really what got me started with this Digital Dialogue project, and with it sort of came out of the, my experience as a teaching fellow with teaching and learning with technology. And I, you know, and I am increasingly aware that the more ways we can blur the boundaries between what's going on in our classroom and the rest of the world, the better. Of course, that can also come with some dangers and things as well. But I think it's really what you said and the way you articulated it just now was really resonates with my own project with regard to looking at Socrates and how Socrates mm-hmm. practices politics, because there's a way in which, the way in which Socrates went about attempting to cultivate philosophical thinking in those he encountered really right. had no, it didn't really pay attention to boundaries between public mm-hmm. and private, yeah. right? And so I think there are ways in which we don't, in philosophy and in academic world in general, think of what we're doing in the classroom as mm-hmm. public practice, but mm-hmm. it really is.
Right. I've been really influenced by the writings of bell hooks in that mm-hmm. way, about right. bringing theory and practice together and yeah. seeing how they are in a lot of ways one and the same. But I mean, there's also really wonderful experiences. Like last week I was sitting in a cafe and a couple of people sat next to me and they were talking about this class. One of the students was just irate about how angry this class was making her, and uh-huh. she was feeling like she was becoming more racist because this professor was so inflammatory and everything, and it was a moment of like a sort of public philosophy for uh-huh. me of being a wandering Socrates, uh-huh. and I said, I'm sorry I can't help but eavesdrop, but may I also interrupt, and then I engaged the two of them in this conversation for about 25 minutes addressing uh-huh. things like white privilege and sort of denial and why it's important to think about those things that really mm-hmm. upset you. And like, it was a really wonderful moment. And that's the kind of stuff that I want to be able to bring it outside of a classroom, but think that philosophy doesn't just have to happen even in a classroom, but right. it happens out on the streets right. as well.
Well, and I think that's right. I think that, you know, we have to think about ways, and this will be interesting with the Public Philosophy Network mm-hmm. too, of how we can have this digital and online kind of right. community, but then how will it then also linked to mm-hmm. in-person, face-to-face relationships or conferences or discussions mm-hmm. or working groups or whatever. So right. it's going to be interesting to see how we can, if we can navigate the difference between the virtual and the non-virtual right. world.
Well, in some ways, I think the Public Philosophy Network, when we're talking about public in terms of public policy yeah. and collaborating with public practitioners, that kind of stuff is, I think, a lot more tangible. Yeah. It seems more feasible right. that can be a really helpful yeah. mechanism for getting public philosophy right. to manifest itself. But in terms of like reaching the non-academic public in the way of right. putting podcasts out on the internet or just engaging right. people outside of classrooms, that might be a little bit more difficult. And I actually had a question for you yeah. about that with, I mean, my own challenges that I've encountered so far in terms of putting things up on YouTube mm-hmm. and just putting random posts out on the internet, I've gotten plenty of positive feedback from mm-hmm. people, emails from strangers right. that are really appreciative of what I've put out so far. But at the same time, there are so many limits and restrictions to what one can do, yeah. how you do it, because like on YouTube, for instance, you get like 10 minutes right, to right. do a video and then it's always incomplete or it's rushed. And mm-hmm. then you have people who don't actually want to listen and they just argue right, back because right. they're anonymous or whatever it yeah. is. So what sort of challenges are there to doing a digital form of philosophy?
That's a good question. I mean, there's all kinds of challenges. I mean, I think there's probably similar but different challenges in face-to-face kinds of discussions. But one thing that you mentioned there that I think is something that I've thought a lot about, and I'm not sure exactly how to handle, which is the whole question of anonymity. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a way in which anonymity is liberating, and you know, you can get a certain kind of honesty maybe from anonymity,
for better or worse.
For better or worse. And I can see. So, for example, I have we have some colleagues here at Penn State who use a program called Poll Everywhere, which is kind of like a clicker situation, but mm-hmm. you can text to it, so sort of students can use their phones to answer questions or whatever that they post up on the board. And in one of these classes that a colleague of mine teaches on racism, and you can get some responses that, because it's anonymous, that mm-hmm. you wouldn't otherwise get.
Right.
Now, they can also be, you know, responses that, because they're anonymous, they're irresponsible and not mm-hmm. very helpful. So I've been, you know, and there is something that I think I need to think more about why people feel free to say things online that they would never say to mm-hmm. you in face.
Right.
You know, so I think there's some of that we have to consider. My strategy in my classroom, in my classes, has been, as we've talked a little bit before, it has been to try to create the space for students to give voice to their own experience. And mm-hmm. so I've been trying to think about how can I empower students to create the content, so to speak, or to put words to their what their experience reading, or you know, in the liberal arts undergraduate studies office to their study abroad experience, their undergraduate experience, and that's been powerful because I feel like I'm trying to amplify the voices of the students. But you know what we're talking about at, with the Public Philosophy Network with our classes is building community, and, it, and so how does one do that? And I think part of the strategy has to be, and not only a strategy, but part of the, I think, philosophical commitment has to be to cooperate, to work together with, and to recognize you as a faculty or as a teacher, you're participating in a community and you're not running it in this sort of top-down way.
Right. Are there ways that, when I think about doing things digitally and trying to foster community via the internet and other things like blogs and getting people to be involved and producing content to get conversations going, have there been any or have you had any success or ideas or attempts to put that beyond even your classroom then, instead of just doing the internet-based pedagogy style for your classes, a way to bring this out further?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that has happened a little bit with the classes because I've had a couple, I have a couple of people who are sort of follow along on the blog, and when this class stuff happens, starts happening on the blog, they'll comment on it, and which is exciting, and that's great because there's, you know, there are people out there who have been, who are really, you know, they'll send links and things that would really be helpful. And so, in some ways, the Digital Dialogue podcast and you know my own philosophical work on Plato and on Socrates has been designed to try to extend beyond just the academic world. I was down, just got back from Colombia, from Bogota, Colombia last week, and I was giving a lecture on my book on Aristotle, but then a seminar on Plato's Apology. And one of the things I was trying to articulate in the paper that we talked about, that I wrote, that we talked about for that seminar, is that the very act of reading a philosophical text like the Apology is a kind of political act if done in common in the way that we were trying to do that in the seminar. And I think that's important, but on the other hand, that was still an academic context.
Right.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I guess for me personally, the way I feel like I'm moving out of the classroom is to do some things with regard to the institution of the College of the Liberal Arts here at Penn State. And so that's where I'm feeling like I can have a little bit of a broader impact, but it's still not public in that, in a broader sense.
Well, to go back to some of the challenges about doing more internet-based technological stuff and getting dialogues going with this. Now, I mentioned the time constraints with, like, my YouTube videos and everything, but the other thing that seems really difficult and sort of counter to the Socratic dialogue as a way of producing this process of philosophical reflection is the difficulty in actually creating the dialogue itself, that there's a point, and maybe if you're lucky, someone responds, but then it's not, I don't know if your experience, my experience so far, even in trying to get discussion boards on like a website for my classes or something, they're not very organic and fluid in their rhythm and tone to keep a conversation really going.
So that was, that, so maybe we're dealing with an issue of writing and versus speaking,
right? Could be.
So that's why I decided to make the Digital Dialogue a podcast. And we were in the, when I began with this project, it was we were brainstorming. They put a little team around you when you're a faculty fellow in teaching and learning with technology here at Penn State, and the team was great, and we were thinking, okay, what we want to kind of try and do something, but I was very worried about kind of using a blog to write out loud and think out loud, and because in writing it's so, there is something true about it being static. I mean, however dynamic it can be through blog, and I'm a very auditory person anyway, that we thought, well, let's try and do it in a podcast, because you know the conversation you and I are having now is, it does have that kind of organic feel to it, but it also, there's something really powerful about putting a microphone in front. I mean, you and I, we haven't had this substantive discussion since you, maybe since maybe you, I was recruiting you to come to Penn State, I would think. So, you know, that's been great for me. I mean, mm-hmm. with my colleagues, just putting a microphone in front of us brings the conversation to another level. But then, of course, okay, but how does that then bring in others?
Right. That's, so does the dialogue happen just between
just here and then it's up online for for other people to listen to, but then they become kind of lurkers. How do you get them to really take an active role in it?
I don't like the term lurkers anymore. I think it should be the philosophically interested.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly, yeah.
Well, and I don't know. I mean, as I was listening to you too, it sounds like there's also an issue between like real time conversation and maybe my question was loaded in that there's this expectation that the dialogue happens like one after the other kind of point and back and forth and everything. But I mean, now if I were to be more charitable to even myself and my future in academic philosophy, that I think ideally another way of doing public philosophy too doesn't have to be tempo-wise real time with conversation. You speak, I speak, we go back and forth. But even in writing with our articles, journals, books, those that do reach a wider audience can still facilitate conversations. That you have the history of philosophy and people are talking back to one another. And I think that that's an element that could still also be developed further to really enhance the element of publicness of philosophy in still a dialogue form and still in writing, which has a slower pace to it. Mm-hmm. But if the intention is who are the audience members to whom we're writing, and then what kind of responses are we accepting in return, maybe there's room for blogs to be able to facilitate something more of that conversation too in writing. I don't know. I mean, I have my own blog too, and it goes back and forth with how I use
I know, exactly. And I mean, I think, but what I think is exciting from my perspective is the diversity of possible modes of communication. Mm-hmm. So we have podcasting, which is, you know, voice and sound, but then video adds something else, maybe reduce. I sometimes feel like the addition of image, visual images actually sometimes detracts from our ability to listen in certain kinds of ways. And then, you know, there's writing. There's also a really interesting technology I think now have the ability here at Penn State to use as an institution called VoiceThread, which is an ability to to put it's almost like a slideshow situation where you can upload pictures to it, and then people can add comments to the pictures, either voice comments or written comments, and then they can add other pictures or clips of videos, and so you can build this kind of trajectory of content together in a very collaborative way. So there's a lot of resources like that, and one of the things that I want to think about, and not only think about but practice. This is part of my strategy, which is to actually use these technologies, because you don't really know what their limitations are or what their affordances are if you don't use them. Is to see how these things blur all kinds of different boundaries, open up new possibilities, but also close off others. And I think that's one of the things I think certainly students coming through graduate school now, like you, have to really be thinking about doing what you're doing, which is kind of cultivating a the way that I'm thinking about it is curating your own work. Now that's not about building a community necessarily, although I think you probably could approach it as building a community around your work.
Well, and actually, so I'll comment on that really briefly, which is it's been really fascinating and extremely encouraging to get the feedback that I've gotten from the work that I've done, because basically I'm not really promoting my work so much as really just wanting to get people to start thinking. And so my motivation to start putting things up on YouTube happened last fall when there was the cascade of September suicides of young gay boys that got national attention on the media and the news. And it got me thinking about how outreach is working and how do you reach young kids, and the internet is one of the best means, I think, the most accessible to get people to start getting really good material. But there's a lot of crap on the internet, of course. So I was like, well, then where's the good stuff? How do we find it? And I was especially motivated after the It Gets Better project was started by Dan Savage. I think that's another good example of using YouTube or internet to get some messages out to other forms of audiences. But then again, I had some real problems with the way that project went. And and the audiences it was reaching them, especially the messages that it was sending out. So I just decided, I was like, well, you know, what can I do? I'll put my own stuff out there and see if I can put another voice out in the sea of voices. And now my title for my channel too is something like Think for a Change. This is the series of videos that I have, which is really just I say a few things to get people to start thinking. And the content of the material has been sometimes I just read from books that have influenced me, because maybe people out there can't get access to those books as easily.
Right.
And then other stuff is my own kind of ideas and stuff I've been thinking about. But instead of promoting my work, I've been getting good feedback, because I'll like post a video if I make one, put it on YouTube, but then put it on my Facebook page. And then I've got my 500 friends or whatever, so a handful of them will look at it. Some even share it on their own wall. And that's been a way to like propagate the message. But then I get these emails from people, and that's the really cool part, where people just say, like, I've been watching your videos, and it really got me thinking. Thanks for doing it. I hope you keep doing it. And there are people who are watching, because I know I can see the numbers, who don't email me too, you know? If nothing else, it's just interesting to be able to see the spread and how it can be reaching lots of other people. And who knows what will come of all of that.
Well, I mean, you deserve a lot of credit for doing that, because first of all, I mean, there's a risk involved.
There is a definite risk.
So, you know, and that's one of the things that would be interesting I'd like to hear you talk about, because I've been even asking graduate students to do writing on the blog. There's a hesitancy, because there's a concern that, you know, a potential employer is going to look at this. What are they going to think? This is good. But, you know, I think when you do it with integrity, you know, this is a great, it's a great platform. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, there's this, and I struggle with this too, there's a way in which a certain set of values which sees the constantly linking to your material or blogging and, and tweeting and therefore feeding to Facebook and all that, there's something that can sometimes seem self-aggrandizing or self-obsessive and narcissistic about it. But is there, how do you handle that? I mean, because I think there's also gender issues involved with, you know, probably males in some ways are more used to, you know, selling themselves and presenting themselves in certain kinds of ways. I've heard some of my female colleagues who are in my generation saying, you know, we don't you know, link to our own work enough and do that sort of thing. So, I mean, do you struggle with that, or how do you feel about that whole sort of?
I don't know. Maybe it's just where I am in my career so far, like kind of budding into where I am. So I don't have a whole lot of work to be linking to, so it's okay. But I think, well, to speak to the first point about the risk involved in putting yourself out there, I definitely feel that. And it's something I've actually been thinking about. I blogged about it not too long ago. Because I have gotten not from so much my students, but just random people on the internet, you know, some people are pretty hostile and aggressive. And it's how to deal with those reactions when you put yourself out there to strangers, future employers, family, like all sorts of people. And it can be very exposed and vulnerable, but it's a kind of vulnerability that I hope I can manage to hold on to for the sake of authenticity and integrity. Because I mean, there's even a passage, if I could remember where it is in Bell Hooks, it's one of the most recent pieces that I read of hers last semester, where she talks about there's a definite risk involved in this and a vulnerability, and not everybody can do it. So I'm testing the waters right now. I know that, you know, do I want to develop a really thick skin and say, I don't care what you think of me? No. But I also don't want to prevent that from, to the fear of that, from preventing me from actually putting anything out
that's
there.
That's part of being public, right?
Yeah, right. So I don't know. That's a difficult line to tell. And we'll see how it goes with more things. But, I mean, it's also something that if future employers were to see what I write on my blog, I don't know what to say about that. I mean, what I write is honest, and what I write is often personal. But then again, that is kind of the blurring of the lines between philosophy and the public as well, that my personal life, and which is, involves very public issues too, is not separated from my philosophy. So really, I made up this word when I first started graduate school. I was trying to figure out, how do I do this? I mean, I for my statement of purpose in my graduate applications, mm-hmm. I said, I want to do philosophy right. for all of these reasons.
Right.
And that was against the advice of some of my mentors who said, mm-hmm. you know, talk about the scholarship you want to do mm-hmm. before you mention anything about, like, social justice. And I said, but if a university doesn't want to take me as a graduate student, when this is really what I want to do, then I don't want to be there,
right.
you know?
Right.
So there's something about, like, integrity and yeah. keeping to my own priorities and values. And so I'm still doing that with my work, too, that if someone were to see what I do, and the word I made up was my philosophy,
uh-huh.
it doesn't roll off of your tongue very well, but I've gotten used to it after saying it for a couple of years.
That's good.
But my blog and the stuff that I do philosophically, even my academic work, is very much rooted to this notion that I've come up with of a philosophy
mm-hmm.
and the way that life and philosophy aren't separated,
mm-hmm.
and they're not for me, and I don't think that they will be, even though I've got advice, like, you've got to manage personal life and your philosophical work. So if someone bashes your philosophical work, you're not going to be bashed as
well,
a person,
right.
right? But at the same time, it's like, well, if I'm talking about these issues that are important for reaching young kids and
mm-hmm.
maybe have affected me too, it's
mm-hmm.
going to be personal
mm-hmm.
in that way. And
mm-hmm.
and that gives it some heart, some
yeah.
real, like, flesh and blood substance to the philosophy that I think keeps it lively and important and meaningful and significant.
Well, I mean, so there's a couple things. One is you're really, you know, this is not new. This is what philosophy before it
of
became
course.
Professionalized
of course,
right,
yeah.
was.
Right.
I mean, for the ancient Greeks, for philosophy,
mm-hmm.
for Socrates as the figure who sort of is
yep.
the founding figure, philosophy is an activity, and it's about living a meaningful life,
mm-hmm,
living
mm-hmm.
well in the richest sense. And so I think you're right. I think what we are, you know, you in your way and me in a different way are trying to navigate is what happens when the lines of the private and the public
mm-hmm.
become blurred the way they do, the way, you know, those of us who are willing to, you know, put more out there about our private
right.
lives or about, you know, where we're traveling or what our kids are,
mm-hmm.
for me, what my kids are doing, what rights do I have and what things should I be concerned about talking about them and what, you know, how much is my need to articulate how they're finding meaning in their lives
mm-hmm.
imposing or impinging on their ability to
right.
create an online presence for themselves, their own personality? You know, what do I owe my family? What do I owe,
mm-hmm.
you know, my, you know, what happens in the university? How much can an associate
right.
dean really
right.
talk about? You know, so all these things are things that I hear you struggling with
right.
At your stage, and I'm struggling with the same
mm-hmm.
kinds of things. It's what the internet has done has really blurred those boundaries that have been were a lot more easy to navigate in the
right.
past.
Well, and actually, on one hand, the tension that I'm coming up against is not so much like, do I have to convince myself that what I'm doing is true to the original spirit
right.
of philosophy? Because I'm pretty convinced
yeah.
that, you know, philosophy is a way of
right.
life, a practice, a principle. Yeah, I got
right,
that.
Right.
I'm on board with all of
yeah.
that. But really,
you did write that in your personal statement, as I recall.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm consistent
yeah,
too.
Yeah, you are. Good. Yeah.
But the real tension, I think that I'm coming up against that actually, and stirs up a little bit of worry and
mm-hmm.
fear in me is not so much as what I'm doing philosophy and is it legitimate as philosophy, but more is it legitimate for academic philosophy? So as a graduate student preparing, you know, in a couple of years to go on the job market,
mm-hmm.
my future is laid out for me to become a professor in a university,
right?
right? But to what degree is the work that I'm doing suitable and appropriate or credible and from the eyes of those who come from an institution
yeah.
academic perspectives, and that's really the worry. Like, I'm not concerned about if I'm doing stuff that's philosophically important or significant, but rather if my path as a philosopher will lead me into an academic lifestyle. That's
mm-hmm.
where I think the risk is
yeah.
that my work might not be credible enough.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this as in my role as associate dean, but now I'm also going to be in a few weeks going to Baylor to talk about to some assistant professors about
mm-hmm.
sort of how they can use the internet to, you know, further their career. And so
mm-hmm.
this whole practical career element is important, and it's something that, you know, you want to be thinking about in some practical ways, but also I think, you know, you need to do you need to take the risk that you're taking within
yeah.
within you know, without being reckless about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those of us like me who are on the side of having tenure and now maybe even entering into the higher levels of administration, to be able to articulate in compelling ways to, you know, deans and vice presidents. And like, look, these things, yes, they're not publications, but look at how they're they're using this. These young faculty, graduate students are using this to expose their work in new ways. But they're also, I mean, I think it's also you have to produce in the old school ways.
Of course, right?
You have to get publications and, you know, the journals. And, of course, increasingly journals are being are seeing the power of dialogue and online kinds of fora and you know the issue is are there peer reviews involved and all that kind of stuff. So.
Well, and that's a really good point that actually is one of the my key interests in the Public Philosophy Network, to go back to that, and why I think it's so important is that the Public Philosophy Network, as I mentioned, is also the hope is to facilitate mentorship relationships between graduate students and junior faculty with those who have tenure, with those who have kind of gone through the ropes and know how things work, but also might be in positions with that hold a little bit more weight to kind of throw around a little bit and see what sort of institutional structural changes might need to be put into place to create a greater space for other forms of public philosophy, philosophy and practice, even content that is deemed philosophical enough. Whether that comes down to, you know, opening up the requirements for what publications will be granted in order to get tenure or that kind of stuff. Those sort of institutional structural changes are important, and that's why we want to be able to facilitate relationships with those who are in established positions, who have a little bit more influence and power with, and then encouraging other people who are coming up so we know, like, what is it that I actually have to be doing? Of course, I want to be published and going to conferences and doing these things, getting my name out there and let everybody know what I'm doing. But at the same time, like, how can I still bring in this other stuff and to know that I have support from my mentors, advisors, or assistant deans? Like, that is, that's helpful and encouraging to know that, you know, there are people who've got your back. And I think that's really important in the sense that there's, you know, people have talked about this crisis in philosophy, that the most passionate, spirited graduate students who come into not just philosophy but a lot of the humanities in general with this like intense fire to make change and do good work burn out because they realize that the academy isn't the place to do that. And so then you get people who burn out, drop out, or leave the discipline. And that is a scary, sad thing if people who are dedicated, committed, and passionate about making changes that really affect people's lives, they're the ones who are the first to go. Well, then we're going to get a very stale institution. And that, to try to thwart that demise, well, isn't the idea.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, what the academy is going through is what, you know, in some ways what the music industry is going through, what newspapers are going through. We know there, I think we are lucky in the in universities in general to have, we don't have some of the same pressures that, you know, the financial pressures that, you know, the music industry and others had on them. But what happens when, to my mind, what we're really experiencing is a revolution in literacy, a different kind of literacy, more writing, more ways of expressing oneself, more ways of collaborating, more ways of putting words to experience, and ways that are, you know, different than we would anticipate. And I think we can't underestimate the power of the of what's happening. The analogy I always bring to it is the transition that that the Greek culture underwent when writing was introduced. I mean, I think we're seeing something on the same kind of scale. And so, you know, how do we as institutionally and as individuals navigate that in a responsible way? I think the question I'm increasingly concerned with is, how do these technologies, how can we use these technologies to enrich our experience rather than impoverish them? Because there are impoverishing dimensions to it, too, you know. But I think the point that the points that you're making about, you know, do we have a space that will allow for mentoring, that will, but will also help some institutional transformation to think about what are we counting as valid scholarly activity. Now, I do think one thing that we have to get our minds around it as a university, I think, is that this stuff that's going on Facebook and on Twitter and on YouTube is not separate from mm-hmm. what's going on in the classroom, what's going on, you know, in the journal publications and in the writing. So it's another mode of expressing that. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can't, to the degree that we think, well, there's this thing over here, the social media stuff, this new media stuff that I'm doing, which is separate from this, you know, legitimate stuff, which mm-hmm. I know you're obviously blurring that, and that's important. We are blurring, and I'm doing it too, blurring that boundary. But I don't think we have to think, a lot of people say, well, how do you have time for that? Well, there's a way in which it's just, this is the medium through which I do all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we have. That's increasingly what's going to be the case.
Yeah. And also, I think, my classrooms, the way that I teach my material so far, I haven't gone to new social media mm-hmm. and gotten everybody involved. That's how we carry on any, really, of our conversations. But there are significant implications for how you are in the world
right.
that we talk about in my classes. Right. And one way in which you are in the world is definitely through things like Facebook.
Yeah.
So I get my students to think, like, how do your relationships and your behaviors, not just in this classroom when you're talking to somebody right next to you or the way mm-hmm. you're addressing me, what plays out in those sort of interactions, but how do you carry yourself in the world, right?
Yeah.
On every level, even if that's via the internet.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, what clothes do you wear when you get up in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
What are those decisions that you're going to go and be in public?
Mm-hmm.
So you just make some decisions about how you want to present yourself. I mean, that's what we're doing on Facebook. That's what we're doing in all these different media. And I think it's important to just make sure you know that you're appearing in public,
mm-hmm.
and it's empowering because you can appear as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you could also do it. Going back to the anonymity issue, you can take on personas too.
Right.
And that's. But I think if we're going to be public and be professional
mm-hmm.
in our lives through these technologies, then it is good to be thinking always about sort of how is there integrity to
mm-hmm.
what you're putting out there,
mm-hmm.
and that's for me the most important thing. I want to make sure that and I'll make mistakes and I'll have to go back mm-hmm. and delete mm-hmm. some stupid thing I said or something. It was funny. I posted something picture the other day from my trip to Colombia, and I didn't even realize that it looked kind of. I think I was making a gesture, and my hand looked like a claw, and it looked like I was almost going to claw the person. And so my wife, of course, who saw this, she's like, that looks kind of strange. I'm like, yeah, you're right. So I pulled that down. I mean, there's things out there, that you have to that happen. And what you're doing, Corey, and how you're taking an intentional and an active role, but one with a lot of integrity, is really great. And I'm really supportive of it. So keep up the good work.
Well, thanks. Yeah. And I'm really lucky and fortunate to be able to be involved in the setting up of something that could be really important and revolutionary, like the Public Philosophy Network. So I'm happy that I've gotten the opportunity to be involved in that way, too.
Well, I will put a link to the Public Philosophy Network. I invite everyone listening to go and check it out and do some investigating. And thank you, Corey, for being on the Digital Dialogue.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been the Digital Dialogue.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You'll find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/CPL2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.